This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Oh, good morning, everybody. So there's much I would like to say this morning and only a certain amount of time. So briefly, Ango is a training period that the origins of which really go back to the earliest years of Buddhism and the Buddha practicing within his environment of India. It's a little loud, is it? in which there were rainy seasons during which they were not able to travel, which was their way of being in the early years. And so they would gather together in clusters and practice together intensively in one place. And so that really was the beginnings both of Ango and of the monastic community, because even within the Buddha's lifetime, there began to be the building of structures, and there were certain places that the Buddha went to again and again for the rainy season practice. So it was sort of the beginning of the establishing of putting down physical roots in certain places to train in. And so the practice of Ango has continued in different Buddhist traditions and Zen traditions, and in our tradition we call it Ango, which means peaceful dwelling. One of the aspects of that training is the appointment of a chief disciple, and I should say that there are a number of students within the Sangha who are ready to step into that role, but we only do this twice a year, so there's a queue. and so this is a training position in the sense that the chief disciple's role is to continue their practice as they have been, to train, but now to be brought forth a little bit out of the shadow and to provide an example of practice, which is one of the most powerful ways any of us can have a positive influence and have a positive impact on others, and also to be challenged in doing that. And so it is very much, you know, the Sangha has one experience of the chief disciple and Ango. The chief disciple is very much having their own experience of all of that. And at the end of the Ango, with the final session in May, when the mountain has been transformed into a different state, and spring has come, the chief disciple will offer his first talk and engage the Sangha in Dharma encounter as a way of mutual polishing, understanding of the Dharma. And so during these 3 months, we in residence here will be practicing more intensively on our Ango training schedule. Many of you who are practicing Ango will be doing similar kinds of increasing of your practice or intensifying of your practice in different ways that is in accord with your own lives and your own circumstances. The point being to just be more directly engaged with Dharma study and practice. So with our Zazen, with our liturgy, with our study, with the Sangha in Sesshin, in art practice, in all the ways that we train, because when we engage more, when we engage, we're in contact. And when we're in contact, the Dharma practice is being brought forth, is blossoming, and we experience it, we feel it, we are benefiting from it, we are deepening it, the whole thing is coming alive. And so while our practice is always, in a sense, to be doing just that, to be engaging and making contact and developing, that in during Ango there's a more heightened sense of that, that it's not just a sense, but it's actually what we're doing. Part of Ango training is the art practice, which all of you who are participating in Ango have been given access to. We've been sent that out. And I probably won't say too much about that today because I want to focus on some other things, but Do take a look at that. It's connected with the fascicle that we'll be studying, which is the fascicle by Master Dogen, refraining from unwholesome action. And and I think is a nice work for us to be engaging in terms of our art practice during the Ango, so please look at that. Seiryu, just say a word about Seiryu. Seiryu means vow of the dragon's vow. And he is in a little bit of an unusual situation in our Sangha. He began studying many years ago, almost 30 years ago or more in Mexico City, his home, with Maizumi Roshi, Dada Roshi's core teacher and our Dharma grandfather, who traveled to Mexico City every year, twice a year, right, to lead sessions. And so Seiryu began his training there with Maizumi Roshi, and then continued and did that for quite a number of years, and then continued that after Maizumi Roshi's death in 1995 with one of Maizumi Roshi's successors, Nyogen Sensei, and continued working with him. And while he was studying with Nyogen, he was ordained as a priest and actually served as Shuso, or chief disciple, within that Sangha. And so did within that Sangha what he is now beginning to do today. So those of you who thought you only have to do it once, you never actually know. So I imagine it'll be a very interesting experience to go through this again for the first time. And so Seiryu began studying here in 2012 with Dada Roshi. No, actually, Dada Roshi had passed. Had you? You came in 2012?
2009.
Nine, that's right. So right towards the end of Dada Roshi's life, you became a student in 2012 and then received Jikai a couple of years ago. And so, as a full life in Mexico City as a therapist, a psychologist, and been doing that for over 50 years, you told me. So he's sort of like the Zhao Zhou of therapists. You know? And so because of that, because of his work and the distance, he will be here as much as he can. So he'll be here in the March and May sessions, and hopefully we're seeing if there's some time he can come in April as well. But during that time, we'll be doing Ango from his place, just as many of you will be, doing it at home and work. So the theme for the Ango is manifesting Buddha. You know, and often say the theme of each Ango is nothing new, right? The theme is something that is always the theme in our practice. It's nothing that we're beginning for the first time. It's just bringing something out so that we can examine it more closely. And manifesting Buddha is the theme, and we'll be studying Master Dogen's fascicle on refraining from unwholesome action. And he opens that with the basic sort of core principle, if you will, of the Buddha Dharma. Refrain from unwholesome action, do wholesome action, purify your mind. This is the teaching of all Buddhas. And this is, in a sense, a very succinct way of presenting the whole of what our training is about. To refrain from unwholesome action. Unwholesome is everything that is life-negating, that is delusion-building, that is in discord, that creates disharmony, that is conflicted and creating conflict, that is fragmented and creating a sense of division and separation. Wholesome is everything that is life-affirming, that is delusion-illuminating and dissolving, that is in accord with the true nature of things, of all things, that is peaceful, that is whole and complete. And so to refrain from unwholesome action, you know, if we think of unwholesome and wholesome in these ways, it helps to see the depth and breadth of what the Dharma is speaking about here. Dogen says, this teaching has been authentically transmitted from earlier Buddhas to later Buddhas of the future as the seven original Buddhas' general precepts in the ancestral school, transmitting and receiving these precepts is a mutual activity. The seven original Buddhas were the first of a series of Buddhas who are said to have preceded Shakyamuni Buddha. The fourth of those Buddhas, Dipankara, was the Buddha during whose lifetime a practitioner came forward and vowed to realize the way. And Dipankara predicted that this practitioner would be reborn at a later time and become the Buddha Gautama. And so Dogen is referring to these original seven Buddhas, and that this teaching has been transmitted from this very, very ancient time. And really, this is the heart of Buddha Dharma. This is the essence of practice and realization. It is beyond words and concepts. It's free of time and space. It is the treasury of the true Dharma I, Shobha Genzo. It is formless form. It is the Dharmakaya, the body of reality appearing in time and space, in sights and sounds, inside and outside. It is miraculous awareness, Buddha, that sees and experiences all things as they are. It's the mind of Nirvana. It is the Sambhogakaya, the body of the Buddha, the blissful body of the Buddha, that is life-giving joy, and that is peace and serenity. And it is manifested Dharmakaya as non-duality, free of conflict and division. It is the 10,000 things, each abiding in their own Dharma state. It is the Nirmanakaya, the manifested Buddha. How do we refrain from unwholesome action? How do we do wholesome action? Now, Dogen in his fascicle, and we'll be looking at this during Nango, takes refrain from and shows, demonstrates, expresses the depth and the breadth, the absolute and the everyday reality of this refrain from. And in that fascicle, he tells the well-known story of the lay student who came to his teacher and says, what is the essential meaning of Buddha Dharma? And the teacher said, refrain from unwholesome action. Do wholesome action. And the lay student says, a three-year-old can say this, can understand this. And the teacher said, yes, a three-year-old can say it, but even an 80-year-old practitioner will struggle to practice it, will struggle to fully actualize this. Each of us can only practice this mind, our mind, what we call our mind, can only practice what we call our life. No one can hold on for you. No one can let go for you. And yet, our holding on and our letting go arises together. It is not done in isolation. It is mutually conditioned, mutually socialized, and those words have different meanings, although they're very much related, mutually reinforced, mutually rationalized. And we should never underestimate the power of our rationalizing machine. Our suffering, what we call our suffering, my suffering, becomes your suffering. They arise together. My pain and confusion is your pain and confusion. They arise together. Transmitting and receiving these precepts, Dogen says, is a mutual activity. That's why we've gathered together. That's why there is Sangha. Our suffering arises together, but also our letting go arises together. Our liberation arises together. And this is another way of saying that there is a personally constructed self that I am wholly responsible for. My intentions, my thoughts, my words, my actions, my karmic activity, the consequences of those activity, my mind and body. But there's also what we could call a collective or a socially constructed, a worldly constructed self, right? Which is all of my outer experiences, my influences of friends and family, of school, education, of everything I perceive, everything I encounter and call my world. And these two can't be separated. Transmitting and receiving the precepts, the teachings, is a mutual activity. When the Buddha first started teaching, his first teaching was the first noble truth. Life is dukkha, which is another way of saying start where you are. Where else would you start? And he taught that, and he taught throughout his whole life in a time and place, a very specific time and place, the time in which he lived, the time in which his students lived, in which there was a social, economic, political, cultural world. And he referred to that world all the time. All the time he referred to those different aspects of those of that world that he lived in. How else could he teach? What else would he communicate except that of the world they were living in? Formlessness, emptiness can only be studied, in a sense, in form. The teachings can only be made able to be heard when they take shape in a time and place. And so he was constantly teaching within and through and about the time and place in which he lived, drawing on the social norms, the beliefs, the religious beliefs, the cultural beliefs. He talked about the caste system. He talked about the different strata of society. He talked about social structures, all towards the purpose of serving liberation. He wasn't really trying to disrupt his society. He was trying to disrupt this society. He was trying to disrupt some society or the system of samsara. That's what he devoted his whole life to. That's what he had been liberated from and enlightened to. And so we, in the same way, we begin this Sangha in this time and place, which is here on Trimper Mountain. It is here within this gathering of august practitioners. It is here within the year 2019, within this cultural time, within this economic time, within this political time, within this time of the world, within this time of the earth. And our practice is to refrain from unwholesome action, to do all that is good, and to study and realize and manifest Buddha mind, which means to practice loving kindness, compassion, wisdom beyond wisdom. It's to bring forth Prajnaparamita is the great mantra, the unsurpassable mantra as a living reality. But just as the Buddha was true for the Buddha, we live in a time in which we have inherited this time and place. These economies, these politics, these educational systems, these judicial systems, these religious systems, these social systems, cultural systems, that's the world we live in. That's the world from which these teachings are presented. It's the world in which they're heard. It's the world in which we practice. And our practice is to put all of that in service to the dissolution of every boundary that would appear to divide inside from outside, this from that, real from unreal, worthy from unworthy, relevant from irrelevant. And so one of those systems is what we call patriarchy. A system that elevates, that is ancient and ubiquitous across most of the world, that elevates the male form over the female form, a distorted kind of masculinity over the feminine. And patriarchy is a form of dominance, right? Its whole mentality is to dominate. And domination is just another way of talking about suppression, of aggression, of control, when the Buddha taught, and so if we think patriarchy is true, if we think that, it's important to study it if we think that, but what the hell does that have to do with Dharma practice? Isn't that political? Well, the Buddha taught dukkha is not having what you want. But another way of saying that is not having what? What you want, get what you want. And get it using whatever means necessary. And so that's just another way of saying, I put my desire over your desire. I put my well-being over your well-being. That's domination. That's patriarchy. He also said it's being with disagreeable people. Right? That means trying to get away from people I find disagreeable. Well, where do I get to that I create such a situation that you, the disagreeable person, can't get into? Or where do I put you, the disagreeable person, so I no longer have to be, my life is no longer made unpleasant? Another form of domination. Patriarchy. And so not accepting our inner and outer world, which means everyone in it, which means everything we perceive, which means the differences we perceive within it, the Buddha realized is a futile, hopeless, destructive, wrong-headed way to try and get to what we're all looking for, which is peace and joy, serenity and fulfillment. Another system that we live within that is yet not unique to our country, but that our country has a unique history of, is white supremacy, which is just another form of patriarchy, another form of domination, where it elevates those who have white skin, white bodies, white culture, white values, white thinking, white sensibilities, white norms, over the bodies, the norms, the cultures, the values, the sensibilities of those who don't have white skin, black and brown bodies. And again, in order to place those we choose to include in that group as a white person, right, I have to build systems to avoid those disagreeable people. Dukkha. Right? Which means I have to create systems of domination, systems of control, systems of inclusion and exclusion. And I have to do that wherever I go. Right? That's the system of samsara. That's what samsara is, to create a world wherever I go, because that's what I call my world, the world. Such that those things that disturb me, that sense of me, that sense of what I need in order to find that peace and serenity I'm looking for, wrongheadedly, is maximized. Right? Which will never happen, but that's the view of samsara. And so I build systems, and I call this one education, and I call this one healthcare, and I call this one housing, and I call this one banking and finance, and I call this one music and entertainment, and I call this one sports. In other words, wherever I go, I have to build those systems. And because of the inherent suffering that I, based on the inherent suffering that I possess, by having that worldview, by being mired in dukkha, I bring that suffering into everything I create. It's sort of like the anti-Midas touch, right? Everything I touch turns to oppression, turns to that domination. In order to both create that sense of who I get to be with and who I don't have to be with. And so what we build, I build a segregated world, a segregated life, which is my experience of the world, which means I have to do something about and with and to all of those people that would disrupt that, that would offend that. Now, of course, that has all kinds of collateral consequences. But because I continue that dominator role, all of those dominated, all of those consequences, because I am in the dominator seat, which means I have established, I mean, think of the founding of our country, right? That the formation of these, what are, were purported, and what we take up as the most noble of virtues, the most noble of aspiration, intention to build a society governed by, for, and of the people, where everyone has an inalienable right to happiness, to life, to liberty. What a noble, enlightened vision. And that that vision was formed within, preceded by, and with the intention, the very express intention to do that for just that group of people. Just a group of people. Which meant most people actually were not admitted. It was not intended for that group of people. It was not intended for all of the people who did not belong at that point to a landed, of wealth, white, male world. What kind of mind trickery is that? That's able to do that. At the same time that I'm creating that, that I am also the owner of people who have been kidnapped and who are subject to unimaginable violence. And that that system is established with rules and governing principles and rationale and nobility and loftiness. And that then becomes an inheritance, a legacy that is passed on, to those who deserve, who are deemed deserving, and not those who are not. And that that system was unique in the history of the world. Think about that. Unique in the history of the world. Our world, our culture, a beacon radiating a luminous light of liberty and life and freedom, originating out of violence. That's the world. Why isn't this our history? It is our history. Why isn't this the history we're taught? Because that would disrupt the sense of who we want to be. We being the ones who create this world, who pass it on. So this is the world in which we practice. This is our world. So dukkha is the action of trying to control and manipulate and dominate so that we fulfill our desires. And our delusion, false views, imputes a rationale, a very reasonable perspective, which of course over the centuries has been backed up with science and religion and all the necessary tools. And if that seems alien, if that seems somehow outside of this zendo, this meditation hall, this hall of awakening, I would ask you this. How many of you witnessed patriarchy in your zazen? How many of you have suppressed, sat on, tried to extinguish, destroy a thought, an emotion, something that you don't want to be? You don't want to acknowledge it. This is not who I am. This must be excluded. This must be pushed down. This cannot be allowed. How many of you have fought against your body and tried to control it, to dominate, to manipulate it? For what end? To find peace. To put an end to conflict. How many of you have judged yourself harshly? Judge, jury, sentencer. And how many times have you done that towards others? Somebody sitting right next to you. Your teacher. Where does the dominator come from? Buddhism teaches that every emotion we have can only arise within us because the seed is already there. And in a sense, the nature versus nurture question is not irrelevant, but it's not the important question. The important question is, what's happening? Where does it come from is important in terms of certain aspects of the examination, but what's most important is it's happening. And so in these views, the worlds they create, all things are not equal. People, objects, and so men inflict this upon women, white people inflict this upon people of color. We all inflict this mind of domination, this mind of suppression on the earth. We inflict it upon ourselves. We are all conditioned, we're all habitually trained to experience ourselves and each other and the earth in these ways. The Dharma is the reality of the natural, the world. It's the, what is natural? Dharma is reality. The Buddha taught that there are, because he experienced directly, that there are certain immutable laws, just truths, like gravity. You don't have to like it. You don't even have to believe in it, but you are subject to it. The Dharma is like that. That's why ultimately the Dharma isn't Buddhist. Buddha Dharma means the Dharma, the truth of all things, as taught through a Buddhist vehicle. We can believe in it or not, but we are subject to what the teachings teach because it's not ultimately about Buddhism. And so when we live in accord with the Dharma, with the real nature of things, life flourishes. And it flourishes in particular ways, in non-greed and generosity, in non-conflict, loving kindness and compassion, in non-delusion, wisdom. And those increasingly, for a practitioner, become the norm, normal. In the beginning, non-attachment is not normal, right? That's why we struggle with it so much. Facing difficulties, honestly, is not normal. We have not been taught to do that. But over time, all of this becomes natural, or really just becomes more normal. It's always been natural. But when we don't live in accord with these immutable truths, when we, in a sense, live against the teachings of the Dharma, when we don't refrain from unwholesome action, when we don't bring forth what is wholesome, when we don't study and examine the mind, certain truths, certain consequences inevitably and essentially necessarily will be brought forth. Greed, anger, and delusion, shorthand in Buddhism for what the Buddha sometimes referred to as the whole mass of suffering. And the karma created within enlightenment and delusion is passed on from one generation to the next. That's what, in a sense, history is, a history of a person, family, a sangha, a government, a community. And so in order, what we're involved in Dharma practice is being in those streams of karmic patterns, strengthening suffering or diminishing suffering. Illuminating wisdom or strengthening delusion, we're trying to shift, interrupt, disrupt, wither up those streams. That happening is our actual lived experience of the transformation of practice, where your life changes. That's how we experience it. But what's actually happening is those streams are going through transformations. And that has to be done, as Dogen says, as a mutual activity. That's why we can't just sit and then get off the cushion, you know, we're like practicing like a Buddha, right? Full on. And then we get off the cushion, we just go back to normal, right? That's just not gonna work. because we are not practicing in mutual activity with other forms of practice, with other forms of training, with other aspects of our life, with everyone. And so it has to be an integrated, but even that is really misguiding, because integration makes it sound like everything is fragmented and isolated, and we have to somehow glue it all together. We have to glue all these pieces of our life together. It's not an accurate way of thinking about it. It is one thing. As I said, the Buddha was not really teaching to disrupt his society, not in an overt way, but person by person. We live in a different time and place. We live in a different political culture. We live in a different time. But we also have a different relationship as Buddhist practitioners. The Buddha could only survive if he stayed in right relationship with his lay sangha and the communities they moved through. And in a very real sense, we here can only survive as long as people keep showing up. Right? That's the only way this is going to work. The sangha only can exist as long as the sangha exists. But we live in a time where I feel like we face an imperative to really take up the full ramifications, the full implications of our vows. Because we live in a time that is a continuation of suffering since forever, but it's got some new twists. Right? We live in a time of climate emergency. We live in a time where we are in the midst of a global emergency. We live in a time where the legacy of our unique form of racism originating out of slavery, originating out of commerce to make a buck. And the legacy of sexism and gender bias and wealth inequity and hate mongering and nationalism, tribalism, the legacy of a loss of faith, a basic faith, of diminishing communities, of a diminishing control over just your mental space, silence, stillness, that is the time and place we're living in. And that there is the potential, and I'll be talking more about this over the angle, but there's a potential in this path of liberation, really in any spiritual path in which a personal mystical experience is at the heart of it, there is the inclination and the strong tendency for that to become a bubble. And that's not theoretical. It's happened, and it's probably the predominant thread. At the same time, if that is not held carefully, then the suffering of the world, in a sense, takes over. And we lose ourselves. We lose the actuality of our spiritual practice. And that tension is a very alive thing. I believe that the Buddha Dharma is profoundly, profoundly capable and made to help us not just reclaim our lives, but the whole of our lives, our earth, our justice, our equality, to actually bring to fulfillment those noble words in the very beginnings of our country, and really in the heart and mind of every self-reflective, caring person. But although I think it's inherent within the Buddha Dharma, it is up to each of us to how we understand it, how we practice it, how we realize it, how we challenge ourselves to live it. And the Buddha in the early years, the Buddha said no to Mahapajapati. You cannot enter, you cannot be ordained, simply because you are in the form, you have the body of a woman. And then he was appealed to skillfully, and he changed. Because he knew that the basis of his no had no basis. And yet, patriarchy and gender inequality was born, was already existed, but was given, fleshed out more in that very moment with the 8 special rules. And it has continued to be a part of Buddhism and continues to be now in all sanghas, including this one, down to the present, even though it has no basis. Various forms of racism exist within all Buddhist communities, East and West. But we're sitting here. So we need to really attend to that, those forms which exist for us, that we are in the midst of, that we are carriers of, that particularly those of us in the dominant group as whites, and the dominant group in patriarchy as males, that we have a special responsibility to examine this within ourselves as practitioners dedicated to studying the way, as Dogen said, to studying the self. What self are we talking about? What's the limit of it? So in the afternoon, after lunch, we're having this forum, a meeting, a gathering. We're just going to shift our place and be in the Sangha house in the Great Hall, and to bring forth and bring in all of you and the larger Sangha into the work that Beyond Fear of Differences has been engaged in for quite a number of years. And part of that's going to be just sharing with you the history, which we've been working on creating a kind of visual narrative of. And so it's on the wall in the Sangha house. So after lunch, if you're not on meal cleanup, please go over and just read through that. Take a look and sort of walk through this history, because this is a really important piece of what's been happening within the Sangha for quite a number of years, but within a groups within the Sangha. And that was done, it was an imperfect situation, but done to try and really get to today. To get to today. So that we can take another step tomorrow. And it's really based on this mutual activity that Dogen speaks about. So in one of our meetings, the Beyond Fear of Differences group that's been meeting for a while, we came up with 10 values, basically 10 dharmas, 10 teachings, 10 principles. And I want to just read through these now, and they're on the wall in the Sangha house, but I'm going to be focusing on each of these during teishos, during the Ango. And I'm relating each of these to one of the precepts, because I personally want to investigate each of these from the point of view, from the perspective of the Dharma. You know, one of the things about practicing and being a chief disciple or doing Jikai or any of these rites of passage or being a teacher is that before we open our mouth, we should have done the work about what we're going to be saying, right? It's like when a monitor says, wake up, they should bloody well be awake, right? When they offer encouraging words about why it's the value of sitting still or the value of letting their mind be, letting everyone's mind be quiet, they should know themselves why that's important. In other words, authenticity. And so I wanted to do this, in a sense, for myself, because I wanted to take up these principles, believing in them, having faith, believing in their wisdom. And this was really a collective effort. And really examine each of these from the point of view of the teachings, right? And then share that, so that becomes more clear, not just for you, but for me. Because that's an ongoing practice. Because even though the teachings unequivocally understand and point to everything that we're talking about in terms of any form of social injustice. The teachings historically didn't necessarily elucidate that. Right? The Buddha talked about caste, but he talked about it in a particular way. In one of the sutras, he said that no matter what caste you're in, if you act, treat people with respect, you will be respected. That goes across all castes. That if you do wholesome, live wholesomely, live well, you will create good karma. That's true no matter what caste you're in. But there were other things about caste he didn't say, at least I haven't seen. In other words, he was pointing to the illusion of caste, the idea that there is any kind of absolute difference, but he didn't go further to try and dismantle it. That's what we need to do. We need to dismantle. And so part of that means we have to examine as practitioners, because we're doing this as practitioners, and that gives it a tremendous power and wisdom and urgency, and in a sense imperative, because what do our vows actually mean anyway? And so the first of these principles is trust. Cultivating and earning a confidence that we are actually working towards our mutual well-being and liberation. That our vows are genuine. Equity, to create just outcomes. We recognize that different treatment, which sometimes includes reparations, is required because of historical oppression and our varying positions in contemporary society. All beings have one essence. But every being does not live equally in this society. Every being is not seen equally. Every door is not open equally. Courage, the ability to step forward, be vulnerable, tolerate discomfort, and hold space for new ideas. Great courage. Accountability, the Sangha, the abbot, the teachers, the seniors, the monastics, the board, the students, councils, practitioners, everybody are mutually responsible for upholding these values and communicating with each other. Humility, recognition of the depth of our own conditioning and the vastness of the path. Reverence, a deep respect for each other's humanity and identities, how we see ourselves. Even though we're trying to become free of our identities, we have them. And they have a function. A deep respect and for the transformative power of Buddha Dharma. Generosity, the willingness to embrace all of our experiences of the Sangha with openness and appreciation, and to give and receive feedback on the impact of our actions as part of our Dharma training. Mutual polishing. Whole person framework. In our study and liberation of the self, we recognize that because our social identities are not experienced in isolation, they cannot be examined in isolation. This is most important. That's why we have to practice together. And when we practice together as a segregated community, we're not practicing together. We're not practicing together. Which means we are not studying and liberating the self in recognition of how what I call myself, is inextricably bound up with the selves of the community I live in, the larger community. Cultural fluency, knowing that that we live in a white supremacist culture and that our views are conditioned by power and privilege, we commit to our ongoing learning and understanding of each other's cultural and ethnic identities. In a sense, this is the curiosity of the Bodhisattva, who likes people. I mean, it's kind of simple. The Bodhisattva likes people. You know, I always thought living in New York, if you really like people, man, this is the place to be. And liking somebody, you want to get to know them. You want to appreciate and see, oh, We share in this world and we live in different worlds. Authenticity, truly being connected with our emotions, expressions, and experience. How do we live an authentic life? In the letter that went out to the Sangha inviting everyone to this meeting, one of the lines said, please know that however you feel about the Beyond Fear of Differences work or these subjects within Dharma practice and our Sangha, whether you're excited, confused, indifferent, or resistant, it's okay. This is very important. It's really like we could meet you at the main gate when you're coming here for the first time just to study the Dharma, and we could say, if you're excited or confused, or indifferent or resistant, that's okay. That's okay. You know, I know that everyone is not in alignment or in agreement with what I'm talking about today. I know that. That's okay. Liberation is not about fixedness. We're not here to all think the same way. We're here really to reclaim our minds and reclaim our ability to actually have our own thoughts. How many of your thoughts are yours? How many of my thoughts are mine? I don't expect everyone to be in the same place or to be excited or enthusiastic or to always want to do it or to want to do it at all. But I do ask, as with all aspects of the Dharma, of the Buddha Dharma, that you try as a practitioner to bring forth a beginner's mind, a question, an inquiry, an openness. I do ask that you care about your life. And you could say, well, that's none of my business, but actually it is my business. And not just because I'm a teacher, but because there is mutual activity. Because what you do, I experience. When I don't care about my life, that's what I'm giving to you. That's what you're getting. So it is your business, this here. You are my business. In the best sense of that, what that can be. I do ask that you be willing to challenge yourself to make your practice real. Inauthenticity is the kiss of death, right? All of us know that. Many of us have had experiences in various religious traditions or faiths or practices and in our own moments where it's not real, it's not authentic, it's hypocritical, it's insincere. You know what? That sucks. It sucks to experience it, and it just sucks as a way of being. That's not what this is about. That just doesn't work for anybody. And so I do ask that we challenge ourselves to make this real. If we're going to do it, it's better just not to do it, frankly, I think. We don't have to be, I'm not saying be 100% authentic. That's a fantasy. But I am saying we have the capacity to practice being authentic. We have the capacity to practice being sincere, even in the midst of our resistance. That's an amazing thing. That's an amazing thing, that we can practice compassion in a moment when we feel indifferent, that we can step forward when we're wanting to step backward. That's an amazing power. And so I ask that we exercise that power. And I do ask that if you express intentions and vows towards the Sangha, to awaken, to live your life in a certain way, whatever those intentions and vows are, that you live them. And I ask that you ask that of me. That's our sacred trust together. That's what makes this powerful. We're not afraid to ask that of each other. And I can tell you that in my own path of Dharma study and certainly absolutely in study of racism and sexism and other forms of oppression, I have been at various moments excited and confused, determined and indifferent, committed and resistant, confident and uncertain. And I can tell you that I have not encountered anything over the course of my training that because it was happening within the context of practice has been as powerful a field of practice and study that is as real and honest and impactful and illuminating as the karmic, as the study of the karmic self, which is for me my whiteness, my maleness, my able-bodiedness, my power. And that the signs that I have seen and the signs that many of you have seen or will see if you engage this, those signs being resistance, apathy, lethargy, and particularly white folks, for men, because we're not used to, in dominant groups, we're used to having things made easy in a certain way. We're not used to being challenged in these ways. Right? The systems are designed to make things easy to the self. And so when I experience resistance and apathy and lethargy and defensiveness and rationalization and on and on and on, those are just signs that I'm in new territory. I am being challenged or asked to study this beyond what I have studied up to this moment. And in doing that, I am going to develop indispensable qualities. Patience, ability to be uncomfortable, honesty, humility, what these values are pointing to. And my life was going to explode because of that, explode in a vast and boundless way. And it is going to have profound impact on each of our ability to actually be compassionate in the world. I mean, all of those things are really just the signs of the self rising up to defend the self. And so as Dogen said in the fascicle, you know, a child can talk about kindness, can talk about compassion, can talk about sharing and fairness and understand them on a certain level. But as that child gets older and really is challenged to live those things, they're going to get their butt kicked. Right? They are going to be challenged in ways that they never imagined to actually live an awakened life, to actually live a wholesome, life-affirming life is the most important. I mean, really, what more important thing could there be to do? And why wouldn't we want to put everything in our life in service to that? And the one thing that we should know right up front is we are going to need lots and lots of help. We're going to need lots of help, lots of support. We cannot do this alone. It is a mutual activity. And so we launch this boat of Ango. And I'm very excited about this 3 months. I think that, you know, Ango is always a time of discovery. You know, we don't know what's going to happen. But when we have practice and when we do it together, what we do know is that much more is possible than we know. And so I invite all of you into that, which is really into your life. Because your life and my life are not different. It's not just that we need each other. We are each other. And the time of believing that that's not so, we don't have time for that anymore. We just don't. The world is too small. We have made ourselves too big, too powerful. And too powerful within our delusion. We're not going to make it. We're certainly not going to make it well if we don't sort of leap into our evolution as human beings and Buddhas to do what has been known and understood for centuries and centuries, but has never been fully brought to fruition. And we're not going to bring it to full fruition either. But we can put all of our shoulders into doing what we can in the time that we've been given. So I'll end with a poem. Snow-covered earth, vast, boundless sky, the limits of the knowable, the limits of the unknowable are unknowable. My vow to myself is you. My vow to you is myself. The great Bodhisattva's love burns brightest within the scars of the burning. And what we find unexpectedly in the scars of the burning is unbounded and immeasurable joy. If you don't know that, check it out.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.